So first of all, thank you, Brooke, for that wonderful introduction. I was really good until she got to the riveting storytelling and all the, you know, you're going to leave with your world changed. So let's lower expectations right at the very beginning. No, it is great to be here. And I want to thank Rick and the entire team of ELO for putting on this great gathering. And give them a hand, by the way. They've done a great job. Yeah. And I want to thank you for making an investment in yourself today, an investment in your leadership, an investment in your growth and your development. Some of you are early in your career and callings, and you're investing in that future. And some of you, like me, may be at a later stage of your career. So it's exciting to see you still think you've got something to learn. Now, of course, how many have been here all day? I'm just curious. So quite a few of you. I'm sorry. You know, it's hard. You know, they saved a PhD for last, you know. So I'm a doctor, but I'm the kind who can't help anyone. So, you know, if you could be in trouble. But here's the thing. I always felt in my younger days that closing a conference was, you know, a great honor. But now I realize closing a conference is a little bit more like being Elizabeth Taylor's seventh husband. I understand on the wedding night, she said, "Don't worry, dear, I won't keep you long." So the good news is, I won't keep you long. But I do want to challenge us tonight with a very simple, but I believe profound idea. And that is that we are in the midst of something that I call the purpose revolution. And the purpose revolution will be the single greatest opportunity of our generation for businesses, and for many businesses, the single greatest threat. And it's a very hopeful trend for the future of humanity. Now, whenever I'm speaking on this in a stage like this, in front of an audience like you, there's an inevitable question people ask, and sometimes they'll actually come up to me and say, "Why did you leave the ministry?" Now, of course, y'all are a little more sophisticated than that. You know I didn't leave the ministry. But you might wonder, why did I now, almost 30 years ago, leave the parish to go into the corporate world to do the work that I'm doing? And as Brooke said in the introduction, now 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Awakening Corporate Soul and really began doing the work that I'm doing. And the reason I left the parish to do the work that I'm doing is because 30 years ago, I realized two things were profoundly true. One was that the vast majority of my parishioners spent most of their life at work. The average Canadian will spend 2 of every 3 hours we are alive and awake as adults at work and getting ready for work during our working years. Now think about that for just a moment, those of you who are leaders. That means that 2/3 of that person's adult waking life, more time than they will spend with their family or their church or their spiritual pursuits, more time than any other endeavor of their life, they will spend working for you. And I always say, if you need a calling as a leader, if you need a calling as a business owner, just remember what people have sacrificed to be a part of your enterprise. So the first thing I realized is that people spend a lot of time at work, and sometimes they were better human beings, and their emotional, spiritual, and psychological journey was enriched by the workplace. And sometimes it was diminished and in some cases even destroyed. The second thing I realized 30 years ago is that business would wind up shaping the future of society. Now, you've probably heard this line before, but it's true. In the Middle Ages, the biggest buildings in every community in Western society were what? You know, what were the biggest buildings? The cathedrals. And then as we moved to a more secular society, the biggest buildings became the government buildings. And in almost every city in the world now, you know the biggest buildings are owned by businesses. Unless, of course, you live in Vancouver, where they're mostly condos, which may in fact be indicative of where the world is going. From the church at the center, to the government at the center, to business at the center, to the people at the center. So let me, with that provocative beginning, talk about what I think the purpose revolution is. Now, to tell you about the purpose revolution, I want to begin with a story that is not revolutionary at all. It's about a man that I met on a recent trip to Sicily this past summer. Now, I'm Sicilian. And, you know, so it's not unusual for me to go to Italy or to Sicily. But in this particular time, I was up hiking in Mount Etna, and I happened to run into this gentleman. And by the way, immediately I said, I am Sicilian. I can see now where my height came from. But anyway, I said, here I am, Sicilian. And I met this man standing there with his goat and a little, you know, bucket to collect money. Now, I think you'll agree with me, this is not exactly a strongly differentiated business. Stand there with your animal, hoping people will give you money to take their picture. But I immediately noticed that not only was his bucket filled with euros, not coins, but filled with paper euros, but he had a lineup to take pictures with him. So I waited and watched him do his work. And by the time I got my picture taken with him, I knew why he had a lineup and why he had a bucket full of euros. I knew it because he was living his purpose. And here's how I really knew that was true, because I paid him before I had my picture taken with him. I got my picture taken with him, and as I was leaving, he stopped me. He said, no, you've forgotten something. And he reached down, you can't really see it here, but he had these little volcanic rocks that he had glued on these little eyes that were like little ladybugs, so two like ladybug eyes staring out, and he stopped me. He said, no, wait, before you go, he said, you must take this with you. This is so that you will have a blessing. I am giving you this so that you will remember that you are blessed and you can be a blessing. Please don't leave without this gift. And I tell that story because whether you're standing with a goat or trying to sell something much more sophisticated, the truth is that people are attracted to purpose. And purpose has always been at the heart of the most successful businesses. Purpose has always been at the heart of the happiest human beings. But purpose, though it has always been at the center of successful business, something is changing. But first, let's talk about what's not changing. Leaders who have a sense of purpose, whose businesses are not just about making money, have always been more successful than those that are about making money. If you doubt that for a moment, think about the singular case of this man, John Bogle, who in the 1970s started a little company you probably have heard of called Vanguard Investments. Now, the fascinating thing about Vanguard Investments is many people don't know that Vanguard will soon be larger than BlackRock at their current growth rate. They will manage more money than any entity on the planet, more of people's money. Still a privately held company owned, by the way, by the people who own their mutual funds and their ETFs. But here's the interesting thing. John Bogle began with a very simple core purpose. You can kind of read it on this thing here. To take a stand for all investors, to treat them fairly, to give them the best chance for an investment return. Now, the interesting thing is I met John Bogle in 1992, 2 years before I wrote Awakening Corporate Soul. He is not very loud, by the way, about his Christian faith. To know that, you've got to actually kind of dig in the archives. But this is a man with deeply held Christian values whose faith has run through everything he has done in those 40 years. He is not there anymore at Vanguard, directly running it anymore. But think about this singular case, this quiet company that had the best interests of its clients in mind for 40 years, and now we'll soon manage more money than anyone on the planet, even though most people still hardly on the street may know the name but have no idea how successful they've been. Now, I want to talk about this idea of the purpose revolution. See, purpose-driven businesses have always been more successful. How many of you agree with me? Businesses that really care about their customers and clients and their well-being over time do better than those that don't. Yeah, of course. We all know that. And how many of you would agree with me that people who have a purpose in their lives, wherever it comes from, who have a reason to get up in the morning that's bigger than making money, probably are happier than other people? Yeah, so we all agree on that. But something is fundamentally changing. What the purpose revolution is about is not that purpose-driven businesses are more successful. It's that for the first time in history, employees, customers, and investors are demanding purpose. If you doubt that for a moment, let me give you a couple of statistics that ought to get you thinking. 50% of millennials globally say they would gladly take a pay cut to work for a company that gave them a sense of purpose where they felt they could make a difference. Now, some people roll their eyes. They say, oh, that's what millennials say on surveys. Let me tell you, every week in every company I am in, I hear stories of millennials who are making that choice. I always jokingly say, including my own two daughters, they would rather live in the basement for another 5 years than work at a job without meaning. So get used to, you know, the empty nest is now the revolving door. They're planning to stay. But it's not just millennials. You see, the two most purpose-driven generations, the research tells us, are the millennials and then the aging baby boomers like myself. Now, why would baby boomers be almost as purpose-driven as millennials? If you think about it, it makes sense. Millennials, highly idealistic generation, the most affluent generation in terms of how they were raised of any generation in human history, in the developing world, more educated than their parents, more opportunities than their parents. Makes sense why the millennials are so purpose-driven. Why the baby boomers? Well, you know, the answer is pretty simple. Because baby boomers at the end of their career, many of whom spent a lot of their lives doing jobs they didn't like very much or did it mostly to support their families and their money, are saying, before I check out, I want to make a difference. And every week, I have some of the biggest companies in the world tell me that they are stealing some of the best talent at the end of their careers from companies that are not purpose-driven to work for companies that are purpose-driven. And what about consumers? Do consumers care if you're purpose-driven? Well, think about this for a minute. 80% of consumers in Canada say, I care whether the company I buy from is good, whether it has a purpose, whether it is making a difference in society, making a difference for its employees. It matters to me. 37% say it matters to them a lot. Every day they're making decisions based on that desire. So, a revolution emerging all over the world, and now finally investors also coming in. Anybody want to guess what the fastest growing investment funds are in the world? Fastest growing investment funds, ethical and social impact investing funds. The growth curve is faster than any other form of investment. And as the head of Fidelity said to me recently, we shared a stage in San Diego, he said, when investors finally get religion, which they will, about purpose, he said, it is going to completely change investing. And the problem is, he said, most people who manage investments have no idea yet how quickly things are changing. Now, as we think about purpose, and I'm going to challenge you today as Christian business leaders to ask a very important question. Are you relevant? Are you relevant to the great questions that your customers, employees are asking every day? Now, my friend Otto Scharmer at MIT has said that there's really an interesting thing happening all over the world. People talk about, are things worse now than they used to be? Let's do a little poll. Those are the old timers like me. Let's say if you're over, we won't define it. You know who you are, all right? How many of you think things are better now than they were 30 years ago? Generally, in the world, better than they were 30 years ago. Raise your hand. How many think better than it was 100 years ago? Better than it was 500 years ago? Well, maybe. See, it's interesting. Because actually, on almost every metric that one could measure health, with a few exceptions I'll talk about in a minute, infant mortality, average income in the world, percentage of the population that live in democracy, percentage of the population that live in abject poverty. On almost every metric, percentage of people who are enslaved, you know, you could go on everything. On almost every metric that we think would define healthy planet, healthy human society, things are arguably better than they've been for most of human history. But if you ask Canadians and Americans, are things better than they used to be? Anybody guess what percentage say they're better than they used to be? Because you guys, you saw it right here a minute ago. 4%. 4% say better than it used to be. Why the disconnect? My friend Otto Scharmer at MIT says, it's because all over the world people know that there are three things that really fundamentally show us that, in fact, things are not better than they've ever been, in spite of the fact that we have smartphones and we're connected to every person we can be on the planet. And he calls them the three divides: the eco divide, the social divide, and the spiritual divide. The eco divide, very simply, is that even though we're living at a higher standard of living than we've ever lived, the creation, this beautiful planet that we live on, every major ecosystem, every major support system of the Earth, from the ocean to the atmosphere to species diversity, on almost every metric, the planet is deteriorating faster than the rate of economic growth. And so all over the world, people really recognize that even though this is like a big Hollywood set, it looks beautiful, right? You know, but if you go behind the curtain, you realize, in fact, that we're just borrowing from our children's future. Let me ask you, a show of hands, I won't game it. How many of you think the path that we are on is sustainable for the planet, for the creation, as human beings? Sustainable if we continue on the path that we're on. Raise your hand if you think it's sustainable. All over the world, called the eco divide. Here's the second divide, the social divide. It turns out that even though we're more connected to each other than we've ever been, loneliness is epidemic. Mother Teresa said that, you know, loneliness was, you know, literally the disease of the developed world. The developing world had poverty, she said, but the developed world had the disease of loneliness. All over the world, there is a social divide between the rich and the poor. In fact, even though more people live in the middle class than they've ever lived in human history, the gap between the rich and the poor is growing. And even more importantly, the sense that we can have legitimate conversations with each other when we disagree with each other. You know, in many places all over the world, it's becoming increasingly difficult for us to have conversations with people who disagree with us. And finally, the spiritual divide, which is really a loss of meaning, a loss of sense of purpose that is also happening all over the world. And so the real question, I think, for a business is, what does it mean if people are feeling these three divides that Otto Scharmer talks about? And here's what I think it means. It leads to what I call the three guilts and the three desires. And this is the heart of the purpose revolution. What's the guilt? Is this product I'm buying bad for myself? Number two, is this product I'm buying harmful to people? You know, think about all the clothes that you're wearing right here in the room today and ask yourself, do you know where they were made? Do you have any idea what kind of conditions the people worked in that made them? Do you have any idea consequences for the things that we buy? And the truth is, most of us have almost no idea. And then finally, are the things that we're buying destructive to the planet? I won't depress you, but I'll give you a really daunting thing. Take a look around this room. Just take a look around this room for just a minute. Now, except for, I don't even see any cans. I don't even see any bottles at the moment. Everything in this room, including almost everything you're wearing, will be in landfill. Almost nothing in this room will ever be reused. And almost all of it are man-made products that, nature knows nothing to do with. So people having these three guilts, they want to buy without guilt, but actually even more profoundly, the three desires. I want something that's good for me. I want a work that gives me meaning. I want a career that gives me a sense of purpose. I want to buy from a company that, you know, gives me a sense of connection to something that I care about. I want to buy something that's good for people. I want to buy something that's good for the planet. So what we have is emerging desire, and then we got one more thing we got to talk about, then I get really practical with you, is something I call the purpose gap. So get the picture. We want meaning in our work. We want to buy from companies we believe in. We want to buy for things that are not destructive to our collective life. But there's a gap. And the gap, by the way, is an opportunity for every one of you in this room as a business. Because the gap is very simple. How many of you manage people, have people who work for you in this room? Raise your hand. All right, so quite a few of you, at least half of you. Remember, 50% are millennials. I'd take a pay cut to work for a company I believed in. 80% of employees generally say it matters to me if the company I work for is ethical, treats their customers and clients like we really care about them, has an interest in making the community around me better. 80% say we really care about that. But 70% of employees in Canada and the United States say the company I work for is not that kind of company. It mostly cares about profits and money more than it cares about the well-being of its clients, customers, or community. 70%. By the way, great opportunity for a purpose-driven leader. You want to employ people. You want to win customers. Close that gap. Help them see that your company is one of those companies that actually does care deeply about the people that you're serving. Customers, same gap, basically. 70% of customers want to buy good, only trust 6% of companies. So here's the interesting thing. I go to your workplace, I want to buy good, but only 6% do I have confidence in the companies that I buy from are good. Major opportunity for every one of you in this room. I bet there are some pretty purpose-driven organizations in this room. Some companies that are doing some really good things for your employees in your community. The question I would ask you is, can people see it? Can they feel it? Because we know when you close the gap, they will, in fact, respond to that. And by the way, they don't believe what you tell them about you, by the way. 16% is the number of people who say, I believe what companies tell me about them. So who do they believe? Anybody want to guess? 16% believe what you tell them. Who do you think is the most believable asset in the company? Who is the person a customer is most likely to believe that you are purpose-driven and actually care? Who do you think? Your employees. 63% of people say, if your employee says, this is a purpose-driven company, we really care about our clients and our customers, we care about our community, we care about the planet. People say, I believe that. 10 times more likely to share a social media feed from an employee than I are to share a social media feed that comes from your business. Now, let's get really practical about this. The first thing is, as a business leader, we have to recognize that how people see their work matters, and it matters a lot. A woman named Amy Wyszynski at Yale University has actually studied how people see their jobs. And it turns out that pretty much every person who works for you and every person in this room sees the current role that you're in, the current business you're in, your job, in one of three ways, either as a job, as a career, or a calling. And it's very simple. A job, I'm doing this just for pay. If I win the lottery tomorrow, you are not going to see me again. I am just doing this because I'm trading my life for what I can get for it. Second, some people see their job as a career. They're doing it for status, for learning, for development, so one day they can do something else. It's kind of a stepping stone to do something else someday. And then finally, some people see their job as a calling, a word that all of you are familiar with in this room from the Latin word vocatio. Even though it's associated with religious professions, Amy discovered that, you know, that about 30% of people are in roles right now that they see as a calling. But here's where it gets really interesting for us as leaders. It turns out if someone sees their job as a calling, they perform better on every metric that we care about as business leaders, every single one. They're more engaged, they're more committed, they provide better customer service, they even call in sick less, they're more productive, they talk more positively about your company. If a person sees the job they are in as a calling, they feel they're really making a difference in their job. It makes a huge difference. If you doubt that, I give you a great example about an unglamorous job that has a fascinating quality about it, and that is zookeepers. Now, you probably never really thought about the job of a zookeeper, but how many of you guess probably not a very glamorous job, right? I like this cartoon, really kind of says it all about zookeeping. Take you a moment to kind of get it in, but yeah, ew. But here's the interesting thing. Zookeepers generally are not paid very well. They they could usually make more money with their educational credentials doing almost any other kind of job that they could get with that same credential. And yet the turnover rate of zookeepers is next to zero. The engagement and job satisfaction rate is off the chart. And we all know why. And it's not because of this. It's because most zookeepers see their job as a calling. And when you see your job as a calling, fundamental things happen. Now, as a leader, there's really two things you ought to think about. The first one is, are you hiring people who have a calling orientation? And, you know, in our company, we train people how to recruit calling-oriented people, but I can give you some really practical things. Just ask someone in your last job, when you went home on what my grandfather called a good tired day, what made it a good tired day for you? If they say, well, I made a difference for a client, I made a difference for a customer, I felt like I really made a difference, you get the beginning of a sense that someone has a calling orientation. But the interesting thing is, I believe every employee who works for you can have a calling orientation, and it's our job as leaders to inspire that. So I want to tell you some of the things we do as leaders that help people work for us find a sense of purpose. But I want to first tell you a story, and I have to admit, I'm going to show you an embarrassing picture of myself. This is me in the 1970s. I will not leave it up there long, just in case someone puts it on Facebook or something. But anyway, there I am. And I'm showing that picture because it will remind you how bad the 70s were. And because I want to tell you when I first discovered that when people have a sense of calling, they perform fundamentally different. My second year of graduate school, I didn't come from a rich family. I had to work my way through all my degrees. And the only job I could get my first year in graduate school was working in a post office in a small like drugstore, a substation on the south side of Chicago in one of the poorest neighborhoods in North America. And I was, I had a calling in my life. I really wanted to do something important with my life and make a difference and, somehow have an impact in a positive way. But here I found myself working 30 hours a week in a job that really had no meaning for me. It was just a job. All day long I weighed packages, sold stamps. It was busy from the moment you started your shift to the moment you ended. And in those days in the U.S. Post Office, I'm a dual citizen, so I spent a lot of time in both countries. But in those days in the U.S. Post Office, they had these money orders you would make. They were like these old money order machines, and they would rip, every time you do it. So about 80% of the time, you had to redo it. And so when someone asked for a money order, it would drive you crazy because the line would get longer. Anyway, so I'm 3 months into this job. I hate the job. It's only a job for me. And I am performing like it's a job. Until one day, it's a rainy morning in Chicago, and a woman in her 80s is my third customer in line that morning. I remember it was raining because the raindrops were still dripping on her shoulders as she asked me for a money order. As the beginning of the day, I'm in a kind of a good mood that morning, so I said, "And how are you today?" And she said, "Well, to be honest, I'm not doing very well." She said, "My daughter is in the hospital. She's in Billings Hospital, about a mile from where we were," she said, "and she has cancer. And, she could die today. The doctor said she's going to die any time now. She could be dying right now." She said, "But if I don't pay my rent by 5 o'clock today, they're going to throw me out of my building." She said, "And those lousy people who run my building won't let you pay with cash. And so I'm the only person in the world. I had to get this money order for me, and so that's why I'm here." But she said, "For God's sakes, my daughter's dying as we speak. I should be there." Now, I have to tell you, I really don't remember much of what I said to her that day. But the first time in 3 months it occurred to me, I might actually make a difference in the post office. And I was kind, I was gentle, I wished her well, but what I will remember my entire life was she was about to leave the post office, the drugstore, and she turned around, was a long aisle, something like this, and she walked all the way down the aisle, came up, came behind the counter, interrupted the next customer who was already doing business with me, and put her shaking hand on my forearm, and she looked me in the eyes, and she said, "Son, I just want to thank you. Thank you for being so kind. You do know, don't you? You made my day." Now, I have to be honest with you, that night I couldn't sleep. I thought, for 3 months in this post office, 30 hours a week, I saw my job as weighing packages and selling stamps. Maybe there was a deeper calling in the post office. And the next day, I literally wrote down on a piece of paper behind the desk where only I could see it, "Make someone's day." And the third woman in line the next morning was another elderly woman in an almost orange pulsating neon dress. And as she was fumbling with her mail, I said, "My, you look beautiful in that dress today." And she looked around and saw there were only men behind her. And she goes, "Oh, stop flirting with me now, would you?" But I realized in those next months that my customers had incredibly hard lives. Many of them were in deep poverty, lived in crime-ridden neighborhoods. And if I showed up a certain way every day, I could have as big a calling in that post office as any job I could be in. And I want to tell you, as leaders, it is your job to remind people of the calling in whatever work you do. Molly Maid is a company I've done a fair amount of work with. You know, they clean homes. Again, not very, thankful work sometimes. It can be dirty work in some people's homes. And yet, whenever I go into work with a company, I say, give me the names of your best franchises. If I'm in a franchise organization like Molly Maid, give me the names of the people running your most successful franchises. So they give me the names of the five most successful franchisees. By the time I interview the five successful franchisees, I realize every one of them, every day, is driving a sense of calling and purpose in their business. One young woman who is off the charts growth for Molly Maid franchise, she said, "Whenever I hire a maid, a cleaning professional, the first thing I say to them is, I want you to remember that in your job, you are going to give our clients the single greatest gift anyone could ever give another human being." And I bet you even know what that gift is. Time. She said, "I tell them, people would rather spend time with their kids, rather spend time on the things that really mean so much to them in their lives. You are giving them the gift of time." The single most successful franchisee had been running it for 30 years. He said about 50% of the people whose homes we clean are elderly people. In some cases, our maids are the only people who will go into that person's home, sometimes over any number of days. He said, "I tell my cleaning professionals, they're not in the job of cleaning homes. They're in the job of alleviating loneliness. I tell them, when you go into that home, remember, you might be the only person that person sees all week. Their kids may live far away." And in almost every staff meeting, he brings in the families of elderly people whose homes they clean or busy people whose homes they clean to come in and tell the story. "Here's the difference that you are making for me. Here's the difference you're making for my loved one." At RBC, a client of ours, great bank, one of the things at RBC, we did one simple thing with RBC that made a profound difference. We had in every branch, they have a stand-up meeting at the beginning of every day in the branch. And at the beginning of every day, we had them begin the meeting with this question: "Since the last time we were together, how has somebody on this team really made a difference for one of our clients in a way that made a difference for you?" And in the branches that did that religiously, no pun intended, every single day, in 6 months, 18% jump in employee engagement and 15% jump in sales in those branches that every day created what I call line of sight between the work we're doing and the difference we're making. And I guess what I'm asking you as a leader is, if I were to follow you around all day long in your business, how many of your messages are about profits or money or how many widgets or accounts you've opened and how many are about the real difference that you've made in the lives of your clients? And what about your customers? Remember, only 16% trust what you say about them, what you say about yourself. Only 6% of the companies we buy from do we believe are good, meaning we have confidence that they're good. So here's a couple of things we know. The first thing we know is that right at the moment of purchase, right when someone is in front of you as a customer, we want to make it as easy as possible for them to know why they should feel good about buying from you. I was doing some work with bankers in Switzerland recently, and my wife and I happened to kind of fall in love with this little restaurant in Zurich called Be Good. It's kind of a nice name, Be Good, food with roots. We went in because the food was inexpensive and it was good. And we went in and tried the food, liked it, started going back. And of course, anybody could say, you know, we're a good, this is Be Good, this is good food, right? Food with roots. I love, right there in the restaurant, in every one of their restaurants, they have a sign. By the way, it's different in each restaurant, so it's kind of changed in each of the restaurants. They put their own flair to it, what we think it means to be good. And what I love about that is it mirrored what we know from the research, which is that if right there at the moment of purchase, right there at the moment someone comes into your store, you can say, here's what we mean. Here's what it means to be good. And so you begin to say, how are we telling our story? Can we involve our customers in making a difference with us? I'm not going to spend much time on this slide, but I want to make one important point about purpose and customers, and that is that if customers connect to your story, they will be loyal to you even if your competitors lower their prices. Ben & Jerry's, great ice cream company. Ben & Jerry's knows a lot of people buy their ice cream just because they love their ice cream. But about 33% of their customers buy from Ben & Jerry's because they believe in Ben & Jerry's purpose. They believe in the things that they're doing around environment. They believe the good things they're doing in community. They believe in those good old-fashioned home values about how they treat farmers and all that kind of stuff. And they know an interesting thing about that 33% of their customers. Even when Häagen-Dazs puts their ice cream on sale, those customers never leave. Because you see, in an age when it's hard to differentiate, purpose is one of the few things that can truly connect us with our customers in a profoundly different way. Now I want to be kind of provocative to you in the Christian community for a moment here. And let me ask you, when employees and customers in Canada, what do you think is the number one social issue that people say would make them think your business is a good business? Meaning good, meaning ethical, purpose-driven business. Anyone want to guess? What do you think is the number one issue? By the way, it dwarfs every other issue that comes by about 25 percentage points. Anybody want to guess? Eco, right. Are you green? Are you doing things that are making a difference for the planet? Now, the interesting thing is Christians, and I have to go on my little soapbox here for a minute, is that to me, as a Christian, being concerned about green, being a business that is driving ecological solutions and caring about that ought to be a no-brainer for us as Christians. I mean, because if you're a Christian, you believe this is not some cosmic accident. This is a creation of a living God who made this beautiful planet. You've studied Genesis where Adam and Eve are given dominion over the garden. And by the way, dominion is a really bad translation of the Hebrew word, because dominion is actually the same word that's used for like a royal king. So a good king, you know, Rick was talking earlier about, you know, some kings ended good, some ended not so well. And I like that, Rick, by the way, because I'm choosing, want to end well. I like that, maybe gave me a lot of hope, right? But, you know, one of the interesting things is it's the same word, not ruler like plunderer, we're in charge of it. It's the word for being a good king. So the idea was God kind of says, look, I'm leaving you the garden. You're the gardener. And yet as Christians, we must face some facts. In the mere 60 years that I have been alive, the immense damage we have done to the creation is unfathomable. Few simple examples. Within 10 years, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than marine life. And that is not an exaggeration. Species are becoming extinct 1,000 times the historic rate. That's why a journalist recently wrote a book called The Sixth Great Extinction, because basically, you know, humanity is now on the process of creating a great extinction. And to me, even more kind of profoundly than that is that, you know, in our one lifetime, I always say my wife and I got to trek the mountain gorillas in the impenetrable forest on the border of Rwanda and Uganda. And I got to hang out with the chief veterinarian. If they're wild, they're not like in a zoo. I said, how many, there are 700 mountain gorillas now in the impenetrable forest in Central Africa. When I was born, there were 1.2 million mountain gorillas. It blew my mind. 1.2 million when I was born. You know, one of the questions I think we as Christians have to ask ourselves is, are we relevant to the three divides that people are feeling all over the planet? Rick and I were talking a few months ago when we sat down and I said yes to this, and we were talking about how, you know, people are becoming more spiritual all over the world. While church membership is declining globally, while attendance at all different major religious institutions are declining, especially in the developed world, still growing in parts of the developing world, is that while that's happening, people are more spiritual. They have more spiritual impulse than ever. They have more hunger for meaning, more desire for purpose than they perhaps have had in a long, long time. But the question is, are we relevant to the questions that people are asking? And I like to ask Christians this question: who is the most popular Christian leader on the planet right now, this very moment, among non-Christians? Who do you think is the most popular religious leader in the world among non-Christians? Pope Francis, hands down. I can go anywhere in the world, have agnostics, atheists, humanitarians, Buddhists. They admire Pope Francis. As Christian, purpose-driven leaders, we ought to ask ourselves why. Now, by the way, many of those people deeply disagree with the Pope on some pretty profound issues, whether it's birth control or abortion or women being priests, but routinely he is widely admired all over the world. And I'll tell you why. Why I think it is anyway. I think because, number one, they see his authenticity. Number two, he connects to the three things that are on people's minds all over the world. The eco divide, look at the work he's done around the challenging the world to look at what we've done to the creation. The social divide, how he is challenging the inequity between the rich and the poor all over the world. And the spiritual divide, how he is challenging how our focus on materialism has robbed us of meaning and our deepest humanity. People sense his authenticity. And even if they disagree with him, they admire him. You know, and I think, Jesus has a lot of fans all over the world. You know, Jesus isn't the problem. When it comes to us as Christians, in terms of being relevant as Christian leaders, it's a question, first of all, do people see that authenticity in us? You know, St. Francis, who Pope Francis, of course, chose Francis. You know, St. Francis, of course, is famous for saying many things, but among other things, he said, preach always, speak when necessary. You know, I had to Google to find out that John Bogle was a Christian, even after I met him. But it's out there. He's not hiding it. But first of all, John Bogle was a purpose-driven businessman, relevant to the concerns of the society and his customers and his clients, and his Christianity ran through his leadership all of those years. And he gives credit to his faith for having molded himself and molding Vanguard. But that's not why he connected with people of all different faiths. People will admire our authenticity. They will admire us if we are relevant. Now, three last things I want to leave you with. First, it all begins with each one of us in this room getting clear about our purpose. The one thing I am absolutely certain of is you will never have a purpose-driven business if you as a leader don't have a purpose bigger than money. Now, I know you guys in your lives have a purpose bigger than money. I know that's true. That's why you're here. But the question is, in your business, is it evident that you have a purpose bigger than money? And I can't tell you what your purpose should be in your business. But I can tell you that the people who work for you, you're really important to them. How many of you think as a leader who manages people, that people talk about you when you're not around? You bet you do. We have immense impact on the people who work for us. We have an immense impact on the communities that we're a part of. This guy, John Replogle, I love his story. He was the president of Guinness. You know Guinness? Pretty cool. You know Guinness North America. He was in his early 40s, life on a string, making a lot of money, living in suburban Connecticut. And one of his mentors said to him, John, I think you need to create a purpose statement for yourself. You need to create a mission statement for your work life. It's great you have it in your personal life. You need one for your work life. And he couldn't get it. He couldn't get it until one day he was in the car about to take his young kids to school on the way to work, and he caught their eye in the rearview mirror as they were, you know, in their car seats in the back, and he just locked eyes with them for just a moment. And he said, I started to cry. He said, because I realized everything I had done in my career to this point, if I was honest, was for myself. Nothing I was doing in my career would make the world they were going to live in better than the world when they arrived. And he literally quit his job at Guinness, went to a purpose-driven company, eventually became the president of a company called Seventh Generation, one of the most eco-friendly companies in the world. And one of the questions I would ask you, if you look in the rearview mirror tonight, what's your purpose as a leader? I know your purpose in your life. I know you have a purpose in your life. What's your purpose as a leader? Second thing is, never forget that even those companies we think we love for their product, it's probably not the whole story. One of the little exercises I do when I go into with entrepreneurial and big companies, I have people at tables like you say, name 10 companies in the world that have been sustainably successful because their products are fundamentally different than their competitors. I'll save you time. We don't have time tonight to do it. No one can get past 10. No matter where I do it in the world, no one can get past 10 companies that are fundamentally have differentiated themselves fundamentally over time because their products are different than their competitors. Now, one of the companies that always makes the list is Apple. People say, Apple. Apple differentiated because of their technology. But you know what? It's only partly true. See, many people don't realize that Apple was just a kind of little computer company that, you know, the strange people used. You know, it was kind of the weird box. You know, many of you old enough to remember the Mac, you know. And when Steve Jobs got fired from Apple and then came back the second time, Steve Jobs had an awakening of his own, and he realized it wasn't about technology. Technology was great. He said, but people connected to values. And he started a campaign that many of you remember called the Think Different campaign. And basically what he said is, only people who are different, only people who challenge the status quo ever change the world. And he said, if you're one of those people, if you believe in being one of those people who wants to think different and change the world, then Apple is your company. And a lot of people don't realize that's actually when Apple took off. The iPhone was an evolution in part out of Steve Jobs' unrelenting commitment to product and purpose over profit. And if you know the inside story of Apple, you know again and again, Steve Jobs, though he was kind of routinely known as a jerk, let's be honest about that. He was not a fun guy to work for day in and day out. But even people who thought he was kind of a jerk fell in love who worked at Apple because he had an unrelenting focus on, if we build a product that truly meets the needs of people and excites people, then profits will follow. If we don't have a purpose, just like John Bogle said, if we don't do what's right by investors, if we don't create things that are really good for investors, it won't matter. They won't come to us. Final thing. I'd like to challenge you to think about, what role are you going to play in the purpose revolution? And the purpose revolution is coming. It doesn't matter whether you're ready for it. whether they're aging baby boomers or new millennials or Gen Z, the people who you're going to be recruiting to come for your company want a sense of purpose, and if they find it, they will work harder and longer and for less money than if you don't have a purpose. 80% of customers say they want to buy from someone that they believe in, but they only believe about 6% of the companies that they buy from are good. If we can close that gap, they'll be incredibly loyal to us. So what's your purpose? How are you relevant to the three divides? How is your faith being a witness to so that you don't even have to speak about it? But someone will come up to you and say, I see it. What is it? Why is it? I was saying to someone earlier, 90% of the time when I speak in the corporate world, they don't say that I was a presbyterian minister. My faith is invisible when I come to the stage. But by the end of my talks in corporations all over the world, I inevitably will have people come up to me. Two kinds of people. Christians will come up and say, you're a Christian, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah, why? Well, I saw it. I could feel it. But the even more interesting thing is non-Christians will come up to me and say, you're like a religious maybe. And but they don't say something, something like that. But the funny thing is, it's said with admiration, not with disdain. Because I don't make a big deal of it. I want it to show. Talk to you about this guy and then I'll close. Name was Ray Anderson. Ray Anderson was an entrepreneur, started one of the largest modular carpeting company in the world, Interface Carpeting. He had a great company, great profits. He treated people pretty well. And then in 1994, a few of his salespeople came to him and said, Ray, some of our customers, especially our big customers, our corporate clients, are asking different questions about our carpets. We never heard of these questions before. They want to know, what do we do with the waste in the factory? Are fibers recycled? What about chemicals? Do we use a lot of chemicals? Ray, they're basically asking us if we have a sustainable company, and we don't really have an answer for them. So we're wondering, Ray, is it okay if we form a committee to figure out how to answer the customer's questions? How could we become a more sustainable carpet company? And they did a very smart thing, these salespeople. They said, Ray, is it okay if we form that committee? He said, yes, go for it. All yours. Then he said, Ray, there's only one thing. We're going to have the meeting in 3 weeks. Will you come and share your vision for sustainability? Now, Ray Anderson admitted he had never given a thought about sustainability in his entire life. But he said, if they're going to ask me to share my vision, I better study it. And he started studying it. And he realized he was actually running a very profitable business, but one of the dirtiest businesses on the industries in the planet. And his business was literally robbing his grandchildren of their future. And Ray Anderson got a spear in the heart. Not only did he share a vision for sustainability with that group, but he set a goal of creating the first zero waste carpeting company in the world. He created technologies that he gave away to his competitors. He went on the road to influence thousands of CEOs all over the world. In the 6 years after he got that spear in the heart, he found his purpose. His company grew by, his stock price went up 700% in the 6 years after, while his competitors' stock was all flat in the 6 years after Ray Anderson found his purpose. But the interesting thing is, Ray Anderson found his purpose because a few salespeople in his company found their purpose first. And by the way, I'm not saying your purpose has to be eco-sustainability. I'm saying find your purpose. Let it speak loudly in your business through your actions. Make sure every day you know why you're coming in, because it's your calling to make the lives of the people you serve better. And you know that's what Christians do. That's why Jesus said, as you know, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be the servant. And let me tell you, I've been a fan of Robert Greenleaf's work, Servant Leadership. And I can't tell you how many times over my 30 years in business, I'll find a successful business, a business that has over time beat their competitors. And then I'll meet the person who runs or founded that company. And sooner or later, I will find out that they are a servant leader. They have a purpose. And the purpose wasn't about making money. It was about making things better for the people they served. And of course, many of them were Christians, but not all of them. Whereas John Bogle said at his commencement address at Susquehanna University, he said, I will not hide how my Christian values have influenced me. But he said, I will also say, he said that I believe what really creates a successful business and a successful life is having a faith in something bigger than yourself. Because when you connect to something bigger than yourself, all of creation rises up to help you be successful. Anyway, thank you so much, Ben, and honor to be here. Thank you.